I'm cheap. Well, people ask me these things about Renzo's rule and whatnot, so I just very quickly wanted to show what I meant about features in the rotation curve being reflected in features in the light. So this is a galaxy, got a little tiny bulge, 4% of the total light. That's the spike there in the surface brightness profile. And that leads to the predicted spike in the inner part of the rotation curve, which is reflected in high-resolution H-alpha observations. There are actually two groups, H-alpha data there and H1 data there. And so that's OK. You can have a maximal bulge, and that makes sense. But what's weird is that you see in low surface brightness galaxies features where the dark matter should be dominant, and yet those features are still reflected in the total dynamics. So that's why I'm saying it's weird about Renzo's rule, just so you have a graphic idea about that. If you subtract off the stellar mass from those things, then this is the halo mass that's left over for these spiral galaxies. That's what I mean when I say galaxies are consistent with living in the same halo. Makes no sense. Lambda CDM wants them to live up here, not a lot, but significantly up here, but also to curl over. Don't see. So this.
So how do you get the close?
You subtract off. No, no. It's the stellar mass light ratio that puts things on the baryonic Paul Fisher relationship.
And sorry, when R is here is the.
Just the radius and kiloparsecs of the rotation curve, and we're not even talking about the inner part where the cusp and the core have. Now that slope is actually fine within FW, except that you never see it roll over. But it's not just the slope; it's also the normalization. So that's what I mean when I say, you know, there's too little dark matter at small radii, and then there's too much at large radii where you ought to see it roll over. And it's the same sort of thing you see over and over again. Sorry?
What is R again?
It's just the radius of the galaxy along the rotation curve.
The lane?
So what is each point?
Yeah.
A point is one resolved point along the rotation curve. So one of these guys, and there are 60 galaxies on there.
Where do we expect the bright radius to be here?
Well, it should vary for each galaxy.
Right, exactly.
And you almost never see that. There is one case, M33, you can see that. You can't really see it plotted this way. So maybe we're just unlucky.
But the unit radius of these galaxies are like 100, 200 kiloparsecs.
In that range. This is 100 kbc here. The furthest one goes out 50. So it's hard to fit one. I knew I shouldn't have done this. But that's a bunch of NFW curves for V200 of 50, 100, 200, and 300. Right. So if you want to be going out here in the biggest galaxy, this looks okay. But then you have too much down here. And that's the same sort of offset that we see all the time in there.
So you already remove bands in this plot?
Yes, that's right. They've been subtracted off according to the mass to light ratio that gives you.
Are those subtracted profiles?
No, that's just raw.
The orange thing comes from the Paul Fisher relation?
The orange thing is fit to those data after subtracting off the baryons according to the Paul Fisher mass to light ratio. And that line, if you evaluated it 300 parsecs, which I did not do, right? So I just fit this line and I ignored everything inside 1 kbc, right? But if you evaluate that line at 300 parsec, it goes right through that Louis plot, which I didn't even realize for a couple of years because I thought there was no reason to even check. It shouldn't happen, right? It made no sense. So Matt Walker and I looked again at this and put together all the data we had. And so now these are the local group dwarfs evaluated at their half-light radius, not just 300 parsecs, but all over the place. And there's more scatter now, but that seems, you know, to follow that general trend. These green points are low surface brightness galaxy from Rachel Cusio Denari's work. All the data are more or less consistent.
I mean, there's still a schedule, an order of magnitude.
How big are the error bars, though?
I mean, lower scale, right?
Well, actually, the error bars on the velocity are tiny. They're actually on those points.
Those ones.
But the real error is in the mass-to-light ratio, right? And if you go and read the 2007 paper, I go through all what the heck that does. And you can certainly get a bigger scatter if you choose your MDLs poorly, but it's still the same basic picture.
Also for the dwarfs, I mean, the
For the dwarfs, we've just presumed those are dark matter dominated enough, we can just drop them on there. And I think Matt put error bars on the figure in the literature, but he used ugly colors, so so yeah, I mean, I think there is some real scatter there, right? But the errors are not zero either, so some of it's due to observation. All right, that I had said things about that during the conference, so I thought I should explain myself. What I really wanted to tell you about was some work I had done with Joe Wolf. Everybody knows Joe, I presume. And we thought we could check how the local group dwarfs fell with respect to the Tully-Fisher relation for disks by turning the dynamical data into rotation curves. So here's Fornax. This is the nominal anisotropic circular velocity curve. But then what these colors show you is the full range of possible circular velocity curves for the full range of possible anisotropies from maximally tangential to maximally radial. And so initially I thought I could do like a rotation curve and measure, okay, that's 19 plus or minus, well, a lot. So we ended up after all this just using square root of 3 times the velocity dispersion at the half-light radius, because that's where the velocity dispersion is.
Do you actually use the velocity dispersion at the half-life radius, or you use the mass of the average lightweight of the same for Joel does in this case?
Well, then that's what we did. Okay. So, Tully-Fisher relation, very tight relation. So these are a bunch of disks, star dominated up here, lighter gray is gas dominated, really tight relation, lines of fit to those data, and then you drop the local group dwarfs on top of there using this prescription to translate the velocity dispersion to a circular velocity, so at least we're trying to compare apples to apples. It's hard to do, but anyway, you know, for the classical dwarfs and the bright ones around M31, they more or less follow the same relation with more scatter, perhaps, and maybe that's just because we're using a different velocity estimator, or maybe they're just more messed up.
MB is the mass of baryons?
Yes, this is the baryonic mass, so all the stars and gas, that's all stars here. We've used the mass to light ratios from, basically, if anybody had made a population model, we use their mass to light ratio. Krupa. It's consistent with a Krupa.
Because recently, Gershenny and company, don't they find very much lower
Yeah, that's wrong. I've talked to Matt a lot about that, and there's a factor of 2 offset between what he gets and what I get, and we haven't figured out why that is yet. If you use his mass to light ratio, well, I'm bugging him for a prescription that I can use here for mass to light ratios, but I know from just doing that exercise that the scatter gets really bad for the stellar dominated galaxies.
But that's impressive. Now, I mean, on this plot, at any factor of 2, it's just completely negligible that we look at the axis.
Yeah, but depends on.
If you curve it, it's over a factor of 2 or 3, and you won't even see it on this curve.
That is true. On the other hand, I did this in my 2005 paper. I just played with the M to L. And what happens is it pivots here, so the slope changes if you lower the M to L, and the scatter starts to go up. And it, at that factor of 2 level, the scatter is then worse than in the intrinsic luminosity velocity relation. Maybe that's reality, but it doesn't make a lot of sense. So, but that's certainly true. That's an outstanding issue. Now, down here, that doesn't matter for these things. They're mostly made of gas. So, where they are on here. So, you know, extrapolating down to here is fine. And in fact, it's one of these things that, you know, we didn't check till recently, because why the heck should these even fall on the same relation? That's the first amazing thing. And so, over here, I've divided out that mean relation from the disks. And again, now you can see the scatter real well. But you also notice the ultra faints fall way off. Okay. So this relation is amazing. I've spent 15 years putting different kinds of galaxies on it that I really expected would not fall on it for good physical reason, and they kept doing so. until you get to the ultrafaint.
So how do you count the amount of barons in the ultrafaint?
I mean, like I say, I take the luminosity and the best estimate I can find of the into L. And that error bar includes a factor of 3 uncertainty in that mass to light ratio. So I've tried to roll that into the uncertainty.
So you think it's a bias, it's a real thing?
Ah, well, so in the paper I wrote with Joe, we went through lots of possibilities. The first one was, do we believe the data? So, you know, these are hard. It's certainly possible that, you know, they ought to be over here. You really have to be able to distinguish between 2 or 3 kilometers a second and, you know, 8 or 10. Okay. If you believe that, and, you know, I haven't done it, so I won't swear to it, but I don't see any reason not to believe it, then it's real. Okay.
But it's for those galaxies where you have so few stars, actually binary is negative.
Sure, sure.
And that has brought down the velocity dispersion.
I don't think that's a general statement. For the very smallest one, they will go the opposite way.
I'm not sure. I think it's like 6.
I think that may be that one. Segways one is on there, but I don't remember which one.
That should maybe be the lowest.
Maybe,
rate.
Yeah.
I think that when it just turned for binaries, you're above the velocity dispersion down, that would be a kilometer a second, something up by a factor of 2.
Yeah, I think it went from like 4.
So Booty's,
yeah,
Booty's one came down.
Actually,
yeah, the uncertainty. It wasn't from binary.
I interrogated Josh and Marla about this specifically. Did you want to say something
before? I just had a question also, since this isn't my area. I mean, if you're missing stars and also you
have to believe the luminosities, yeah, sure.
Okay. How
do you adjust the luminosities? I mean, don't you, like, you estimate the luminosities statistically, right?
You have to really separate the luminosities.
So you have to say
these are...
You have a population synthesis problem, right?
Like, how many number of stars, I draw that number of stars repeated. That's the question I can tell the luminosity function, and figure out what the average luminosity
is.
So...
Okay. Actually, Beth, maybe you should say that out loud, because... How do you estimate... The question is, how do you estimate the luminosity of these things?
You figure out how many stars are in the object. You fit a profile. You actually count the number of stars. You extrapolate what's missing. So you assume an IMF. You figure out the total number of stars. You repeatedly draw that number of stars from the theoretical stellar luminosity function, and then say what the average luminosity that you would expect that number of stars to contain. And then the uncertainty is what you would get from shot noise, drawing from that initial mass function, assuming that you have a good calculation of the number of stars. So the IMF is a big uncertainty.
What's the lowest luminosity star you can see at these objects? I mean, is it a few solar masses or not?
Oh, no,
we
get below the main sequence runoff, so it's less than a solar mass. And loosely speaking, the number of stars that have been estimated uniformly based on the shallow SDSS data set, the number of stars that are thought to belong to the ultrafaints for the shallow data sets are consistent with the uncertainties of what we find when we go to fainter magnitudes. Very, very deepest studies, for example, Coma Berenices, which we see several magnitudes fainter than the main sequence turnoff. I can't remember now, but I think it might be, you know, 0.8 solar masses or something like that. There are hints that the IMF is different in those regions, and Marla is going to be here really soon. She does PI, but it's just difficult to support that one.
And for the ones where, I mean, from what I recall, Louis telling me last week, some of them are very easy to, and you probably know this as well, some of them are very easy to distinguish based on their velocities compared to the stars in the Milky Way, but some of them are more difficult. So I can imagine that you're off in your normalization because you missed some stars or you included some extra stars.
And so there's a statistical subtraction of foregrounds, so just as far as looking at the color magnitude diagram, statistically it tends to be okay. The trickier thing is doing a robust measurement of that circular velocity, because then if you have a few contaminant stars, it matters a lot more. When you do a color magnitude collection to try to figure out how many stars are in your population, a few more here and there isn't going to kill you qualitatively. But having a few contaminants in velocity space could kill you qualitatively. So, and it looks like, I'm guessing that the green square with the largest measurement uncertainty and circular velocity is probably Moody's 1.
Yeah, I think that's right. And this is 2 years old.
And that reflects the Kolbasov study.
I think this is pre-Kolbasov.
Yeah, this is pre-Kolbasov.
I'm looking at the Kolbasov abstract now because they actually said that Moody's 1's velocity dispersion did increase by a factor of 2, but yeah. They also said that Moody's 1 is very poorly modeled by a single velocity Gaussian, and that looks like there's a hot and a cold stellar population, which also superscrews potentially with the calculated circular velocity.
Yep, no, that's right.
Just for the record, what did the velocity of Moody's 1 or 2, whatever it is, go from 2 to 1?
So 6.5 kilometers per second was reported originally. I think that was Munoz et al. And then here, they favor a two-component population, the cold component having 2.4 kilometers a second, the warmer component having 9 kilometers a second, and if you just do the sloppy thing, that gives you 4.5 kilometers a second. Which is sort of why I thought that green point seemed like a reasonable reflection of
Well, okay, so I think that is a great summary of just how hard this is to do, and it is also gives you an idea that your colleagues are competent, and people have tried their best, and it could well be that some of these will migrate, but I think it's hard to just disbelieve it.
They're not going to go down to 1 kilometer a second, which is what they would need to be to follow that.
For this guy, yeah.
He's not. Yeah. They're not.
I think they will go closer to the line.
So, I'm sorry, I missed what the y-axis is on the right plot in my...
So this is just the same thing divided out that line. Okay, so there's a deviation from this.
Okay.
Now we put the globular pluses on these. Like you can be basically sitting on the upper right around 10 to 5 and a few kilometers per second. So that seems like, if you would count those in,
globular clusters sort of go like this. I forget exactly. They have a different slope. Yeah, they have a, you know, they're the right luminosities, yeah, but they have a different mean slope. If you plot size as a third axis, then globular clusters separate out, and they behave as Newtonian systems should. They know about their stellar size, whereas these don't.
Right. If you actually looked at this particular plot size.
Oh yeah, there's no, well actually I can't say that, but yeah, no, we'll see that actually. So, but this is something that's been a long-standing puzzle to me, is that there's no deviations from Tolley-Fisher with size. Like, see, there are no ultra deviations, and I'll show you a plot of that for the ultra things. Okay. So we'll now be looking at a lot of plots like this, these deviations plotted against other things.
I don't know, that might be inappropriate to ask this. I'm not sure.
Go ahead, please.
So the Tolley-Fisher relation is just an empirical fact of nature, correct?
It seems like a law of nature. Please continue.
The point being, it was not predicted by some theory. I don't think it was.
It was posted. It was posted.
So the question I have is like, why? I mean, okay. First of all, let's establish: is it predicted or posted?
Predicted.
It was named after two observers, right? So it can't be. It's an observed relation, right? Right.
So it's post-dictated. They saw the relationship and then they said, if the mask is wide, then the Birbal theorem or blah, blah, blah.
That makes sense.
It's a post-dictated.
So,
I don't understand it. It is not something that's easy to understand.
Oh, yeah,
so I wouldn't say it's predicted.
Theoretically,
not.
So this is a question I have. So
he did it many times, differently each time, asserted it was right each time.
Why are you shaking your head and thinking it's theoretical?
I think it's not hard.
No, I mean, it's right, it's kind of, it's at some level obvious, right?
Can you explain it in one sentence then? It's not hard. I mean, of course, you can always build a model that
the usual.
But it has a lot of knobs you have to turn, right? It doesn't say why this knob goes to this particular value, the temperature, etc.
I mean, so you have to allow yourself that freedom that galaxy formation in general has. And within that freedom, there's absolutely no problem. People better have been trained.
That's different from predicting.
In fact, those models that fit this slope will automatically predict that the scatter does not correlate with the scale and all sorts of things. So,
but that's post-dicted, Frank. You wouldn't have predicted that. I predicted.
I wasn't predicted, but when we looked at the models, when people showed in the data that it was there, the models already had it there without any addition to it.
I think that is a great overstatement, Frank.
No, it's not.
For a long time, there was a problem in semi-random models to try to get that and the luminary function simultaneously to the radar.
That's correct.
So evidently, it was not very easy.
Yeah,
the physics is simple, it is exactly that.
Yeah. I mean, this is the usual interpretation, right? That the luminosity is proportional to the stellar mass, proportional to the total halo mass, because of some scaling power of the velocity. And it's not true, right? It's not that easy, because the natural slope for this last piece is 3, right? That's what we actually do understand from the simulations, that the total halo mass scales as the virial velocity cubed, neither of which we measure, right? Now, what we observe is that the observed baryonic mass scales is approximately the fourth power of some circular velocity at much smaller radius that we do observe, okay? And so all the trick, whether you say it's natural or not, falls in relating these things to these things. That's a whole nother talk, and I'm happy to get into it, but...
But I guess the point that I was trying to bring up in with my broad and perhaps too broad question was, why do we have any reason to believe that this relation should still be valid down at these scales? And like, if there's galaxies that don't fall on, being it's not some theoretical relation that's sort of predicted a priori.
No, I don't think so. I mean, I think it's better than we expected, naively. Like, I mean, the thing that first started driving me nuts about it is that low surface brightness galaxies fall on there.
No, it's clear that, right.
That's
this figure could be hinting at something interesting, but we don't have a theory for that line yet.
Frank has many theories for that line.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, I have theories for that line. My first theory fails miserably because it predicted the shift with surface brightness. Okay. That goes all the way back to Aronson. If you go back and read Aronson et al. 79, that was built into that. Okay. So you can come up with another theory, but it's not obvious that you can do that without breaking something else. Okay. That's a really deep thing which we can come back to if we want, but if I can push on. It's not obvious that I was pretty amazed that these things were in the vicinity, and maybe these things are high, but I think that's within the scatter. These things are definitely low, unless we just don't believe the data, which, I'm reluctant to go that far. These things are pretty well measured, Ursa Minor and Draco, and they're pretty clearly low. I mean, in the mid-90s, I think you could argue about whether that was significant or not. I think it's true now. And so that's why I would say I would count these among the ultra faints, and that they're shifted off of Tully Fisher when nothing else.
There's just no significant gas that could be contributing?
I don't think so. Leo T is the only one of these guys known to have gas, and it's on there fine. It's also far away.
And if you strip, which direction do you look?
Now that's a good question. So there are lots of evolutionary vectors. One can imagine that you don't need one because the data are wrong. You can imagine that you start up here at a constant sigma and go down, perhaps because you get stripped as you fall in, so you didn't make very many stars, but you're still in that dark matter halo. Take away the gas before it can make more stars, so you would move more or less down. The evolutionary vector can have a slope, right? So it depends in detail on the model. Stripping the gas, I would assume, would mostly just move you down. You could also imagine some tidal effect that stirred up the velocity so that the thing started over here and evolved to the right, okay? And so I think that's exactly the question I want to get this group of people thinking about.
Well, that should not be okay. Because you're interpreting VC as reflecting the potential, not the velocity explosion of the stars. So in principle, if you just heat up the stars at the same potential, if your method works correctly, you should still infer the same VC. If you don't, then the rate that you infer VC from the velocity explosion of the stars is wrong.
How can you
stir around the stars without doing anything?
Well, that's
mean, that's impossible. You have to do it correctly.
As usual,
you will change that metric.
As usual, Amina has leapt to the head of the class here, because the point I'm trying to make is that when you make these calculations, you're assuming it's an equilibrium. And that kind of scenario suggests maybe that's not true. So that's why it's not representative of the... Right now, it's just...
It's a problem with measuring it, but if you look at systems where you know what's going on in simulations, if you look at dark matter profiles on them, then they just, whether you strip them or whether they accrete more mass, they just go along assuming the correlation that there is.
Yeah.
So all these evolutionary vectors just go back and forth like this.
Is that true in Pinarubia's simulations? I thought he was...
They deviate slightly, but then they come back. So they sort of, they zigzag. But the
Golombian simulation. So if you measure a gradient in the velocity, the thing is completely disrupted, then you measure the orbital rate. This might be true from some very few objects, I think. Right? So you're not measuring anything related to the mass, you're just measuring the gradient.
And like I say, I just want to get us starting to talk about it, so I don't want to interrupt you from doing so. And I'm just right now saying what the possible vectors are in a very general sense. I'm not advocating any specific situation. Now, it may be, as you say, it's not possible to do that. But I think we need to think about that.
Well, like the result that you reference, that depends on the force living in an NLVPL, correct?
No.
The current NLVPL results.
No, there are many simulations that look at sweeping of payloads. Mm-hmm.
But when Pinarubia compared what happens to Cuspid core dwarfs when they undergo tidal disruption, you get different results.
So I'm talking about cosmological purposes.
So, yes, short answer is yes. I want to give a special thanks to Oleg, because Joe and I met and started talking about this at a workshop he hosted in Ann Arbor. So if he ever does it again, I would encourage you to all attend. It's a great environment like this one.
So is there a general statement about the surface brightness of the red points compared to the blue and...
The surface bright, I'll show that too.
Okay,
so actually there's two versions of this. This is the original one we published. And so now we're just looking at those deviations, right? If everything fell on Tully Fisher, they'd be on that line. As a function of the luminosity, size, surface brightness, and metallicity. Of course, metallicity and luminosity correlate with each other, so they both correlate pretty well, since luminosity does. And I think to the extent that luminosity is correlated with the deviations, then that's just what you're seeing both in surface brightness and effective radius.
Is the luminosity what you use to measure the magnetic mass?
Yes.
So
it is strange. No. I mean, if you want to go back and look at that, what it's essentially saying is you get down to a certain velocity dispersion, and it just turns a sharp corner here. So these things are roughly, the same velocity dispersion at very different luminosities.
So the y-axis is
It is for these things, and all I've done is divided that line out so you can see the trends easier. I'm not trying to pull a fast one. Okay. Oh, so that's why the extra red points are from Eric Tollerud's for a recent splash.
So Stacy, what would you say is a more correct representation of this cutoff? Is it really just a single relation in the cutoff, or is it a different slope?
I fit a slope to it at the time, and there is it's very steep, something like a slope of 8 or something, but plus or minus a lot. So I don't say we can really resolve that.
Where does incompleteness kick in? Like
all over the place.
You wouldn't be able to see things with 1 or 2 kilometers per second.
Well, that's not obvious. We don't know the velocity dispersion of a system when we just see the overdensity in stars, I don't think. So.
But yeah, we don't know. There's no obvious mapping between luminosity and circular velocity at the scale. Better speak in terms of, density right now.
I guess if they live, the spatial distribution of the stars is much more extended, it's that luminosity is much lower surface brightness, it would be
Right, so can you imagine that when we go back one, can you imagine that really there are more points to the left of those rings?
I could
have just missing them.
I could imagine scenarios.
Yes, yes, of course.
But it's not clean to say the observational detection limits necessarily map it to that region of velocity there on class space.
So another objection to the moving down by stripping thing is the luminosity metallicity relation, right? We heard that many times in the conference. You can't start with somebody here and move it there without violating that relation. Now, I've seen better relations than that get violated eventually, but that is a constraint that we should not throw away lightly. Please, this is great. No, I mean, this is the point of a discussion. So.
I yield the floor to my CEO.
So if you wanted to think about the stripping thing and look at sort of a scaled up analog and look at clusters, would there be a turnover there, or it's a straight line?
So in big clusters, people have looked for stripping there. What's her name? A grad student of Jacqueline van Gorkum's did this recently. I'm sorry, I'm terrible with names. And you can see the H1 getting stripped in many spiral galaxies. Those things do not obviously fall off the Tully-Fisher relation.
So if you plot that analogous plot, it's a straight line.
Pretty much. Yeah.
So if you go back one slide, and I really mean just one.
No.
Yes.
This one. Okay.
This one. So before you showed, I mean, when you showed this, if I look at this luminosity deviation plot that you have, I can almost imagine two scenarios. One is what the eye tells us is that there's sort of a slope that's going through there. The other one is that you could say the older faints are a separate population that follow that is shifted down, it's flat and it's shifted down.
Yeah.
But when you add those additional Andromeda satellites, it makes it look a lot more like a slope. So if you now go to the next.
So this is the published plot from 2 years ago. These I added last night.
Without the airplanes.
Yeah, well, it was last night. It's actually a pain to propagate the error bars into that divided out version, so I didn't. But I did look, and I mean, these things do look to be significantly offset. Maybe not these guys. But.
Is it possible that your error bars are diagonal on this
thing? Yeah, what I've done is projected the error ellipses into this space, which is why it's a bit of a pain. Eric did not publish a table that included metallicities, for example, so those things don't appear there. If they're known, I haven't extracted them from the literature yet.
Okay, my point maybe still holds for the other plots. Is you can almost postulate
that the ultra faints are just different.
The ultra faints are just a completely different population that may have a similar relation, it's just offset.
Oh, that's interesting. Now, if you plot giant ellipticals back on that Tully-Fisher relation, they're offset in the same sense, not as much. But I think the reason for that is that you're looking at the velocity dispersion, smallish radii, and any mass model you build for those things has a declining rotation curve. You're just not getting out far enough to have a comparable velocity. Whereas that's certainly not the case here. But it's a good point. I mean, they could just be offset. I don't know why.
Don't look at me like that's possible.
You should look at the
C-star. If you convert the star mass dispersion of massive ellipticals into circular velocity, it's not that the circular velocity is lower than the stellar mass dispersion. Actually, the equivalent rotation curve is 10 alpha.
After it's fallen for a while, just for a bright spiral galaxy. Yeah, okay, the mass model.
One very important difference between the ellipticals and the spirals, okay, in terms of this relation, is for the spirals, it's called Tully-Fisher relation, and the scatter does not correlate with size or surface brightness. For ellipticals, it does. And that's an important difference.
Yeah.
And therefore, it's interesting to see where you're going to come there, I hope, that whether these things, which are also basically spheroidals, whether they also have this thing where the surface brightness correlates with the scatter.
Well, that's what you're seeing there. Scale, can I mean, yeah, there's a trend, but it looks to me like it's just this trend, right? This and this give you that, and that's better than either of those. All right, luminosity is just surface brightness times square of the radius. All right, so there is a because there's a correlation with luminosity, radius is just reflecting that poorly. There's more scatter. Same thing for surface brightness. So it's not obvious that that's what's going on. Metallicity is, yeah, it's pretty, and I'll come back to that.
And it's more fundamental than any of the others.
It may well be. There are other things that these deviations correlate with. One is just the distance. I went in this morning and calculated the overdensity, and since rotation curves are approximate with flat, it just basically ended up looking like the inverse of this plot. But again, it looks like, well, you know, the bright things are okay, and then the ultra faints are just offset. So certainly, if we count Ursa Minor and Draco among them, it just looks like two populations again.
Is this not correlated to a selection?
Well, I mean, I'm just using all the data I have, and I can't begin to say what the selection bias is in the local group dwarf. So that could be. As you go further out.
Yeah, none of those things that we know about with the green dots within 50 kVc within the found limit greater distance.
Yeah, that's right. So it could well be that there are things like that down there. So I wouldn't say this is a great correlation anyway. Right. This is, I found, very intriguing. The deviation correlates with the ellipticity of these things. A lot of these things look really messed up. Some of them look round. That's the toy picture we have in our head, that there's dwarf spheroidals. A lot of them are not very spherical. These ellipticities over a half over here. Okay. And the deviation does seem to correlate with that, with the exception.
So you use the Jesus meter for things that
are I haven't used any mass estimator. I've used the observed velocity dispersion at that half-light radius as massaged by Joe. But if you just plot the velocity dispersion and observe, it's not really any different.
But is there plenty of ellipticities?
Indeed.
I think there's a few green points missing in ellipticities less than 0.4. And maybe it's based on more recent calculations and maybe
those are anomalies instead. I hope that's true, because I thought we had all the data at the time.
Yeah, you know, like, the most recent calculations of ellipticity, and there is still an offset,
Well, I mean, this guy, for example, is consistent with zero. That's an upper limit. Yeah. So it's not a perfect correlation, but I am struck by the absence of things here and the absence of things there. Now, it may be that that's getting filled in, so that's important to the interpretation, if that's true.
If you get this distribution right here, let's say you build a galaxy, let's say within either an oblate or a prolate with given Boston dispersion tensor, and now you randomly distribute this on the sky, right, and you take 20 out of those, right, do you really represent the true Boston dispersion in any reasonable way? Because, I mean, especially if you make things very prolate or oblate, right, I mean, orientation effects become very important.
Absolutely.
Small samples, you might be systematically, except for one, right? Some of you might get a prolate one along the longest axis and your dispersion shoots up.
Sure.
It sort of brings you back to the average. But if you have a small sample, you might be systematically.
Well, now you say it, there's another selection effect here, isn't there, that you're going to see a higher overdensity if you're looking along the line of sight. So maybe that goes together. I don't know. So that in these cases, the velocity of the dispersion would be overstated for that reason, not mismeasured, just overstated. And
it's the same as having a disk, right? You get more edge-on system just because there's more solid angle for a random, right, global vector. So there might be a bias in here towards this particular velocity dispersion in systems which are not spherical.
I think that's a good potential explanation for this, because I really didn't expect to see this kind of trend. And it's a little hard
to
understand.
Another one, which is again, you paint the system to be more tidally preserved, so there will be more illumination.
Yeah, we'll come to that. Yes.
That's a statement. That's what I was talking about.
Huh?
Yes, it does.
Can you generally say that painted systems will be?
No. I mean these ones, these guys. If they are not in dynamic equilibrium, say they have been strongly tidally perturbed, there will be more elongation. If they are at the point of being disrupted, there will be more.
So, in fact, these bottom two plots are indicators of tidal disruption that Bellazzini made up. I can't begin to explain that one. This tidal susceptibility of his, the units are kind of bogus, but it's basically a ratio of Roche lobes, so ratio of densities of host and satellite. And again, surprisingly good correlation. I even went so far to say a sextant here might be retrograde, because it's not following the rest of that. But, basically this, taken literally, suggests that the ultrafaints are more tidally disturbed.
Is this sort of another statement of missing satellite problem, in the sense that, missing whatever, I don't want to call it.
If the ultrafaints lay on the Baryonic-Kelly Fisher relation, then you get a velocity function which was in a lot better agreement with simulations.
Not really. I mean, there's actually some tension between those things.
But
this makes it worse.
You need the baryonic fraction to go down like this to have a missing whatever problem. Right?
Yeah. So we'll show an explicit plot about that.
Stacey, I'm sorry. Can you just repeat in a sentence? Did you say that, taken at face value, these things suggest that as a population, ultrafaints are more effective by tidal forces?
Yes.
Than
the bigger classical dwarfs. Yeah.
What does? Just the x-axis of the tidal susceptibility. The fact that it correlates with the y-axis means nothing.
Maybe.
I mean, that's based on the postulate that they, if they wouldn't be tidally suspected.
That they would, yeah, that's right. It depends on your.
Which is no reason.
That's right. No. It depends on
it
your
really
prior.
Is no reason
yeah, yeah.
That should be
no. That goes back to the prior that I'm going to say, and maybe they're just a different population. Maybe they're just different, right?
So my guess is that FT, whatever that is, correlates better with stellar luminosity, and then you just get this correlation because it correlates with luminosity. It's not,
yeah,
there's no causal connection.
Well, maybe. Maybe.
It correlates with luminosity, possibly because we can't see faint lights.
Maybe. Okay, so now this is it's coming on to this. I had many of the same thoughts that it's just a fluke to have anything to do with the tides because it really shouldn't. But the ellipticity does correlate with the distance, and some of these things, as others here have noted, are really messed up. And this guy, highest ellipticity, and look at that. It's already a stream, practically. And this thing's really messed up. They're not. They look like they've been tidally messed up. Okay. Now, I know that's not a quantitative statement, but I think it's hard to simply dismiss that this is a possibility because we have an idea in our head that it shouldn't happen.
Say from simulations, if you take something which starts off reasonably spherical and you sort of stretch it up to that level, what do you do to the dispersion of the system?
Pinarubia addressed this.
What do you do?
Basically, the dark matter gets stripped, but the inner stars are well cocooned and don't come out. But also, the velocity dispersion does not change very much until very late in the behavior, and then it evolves very rapidly as it gets right down to stripping the last little bit. So maybe that's what we're seeing. I don't remember that the vector was exactly right from the simulation to the data.
If the dispersion moves up, right, and this effect of disruption would move it off any relation to. Right, to higher dispersions, even though you cannot apply any equilibrium theory to this anymore.
Exactly.
So,
exactly.
But actually, I get back to my point of relaxation times, which I think I brought up. Right? I mean, these things are like 100 kiloparsecs, and they're like that small. How can like
I mean, the crossing times of the stars in the galaxy is like orders of magnitude larger than the...
It depends on what you put in for the mass, though.
Yeah,
so if you do exactly that, then you infer just this, that the deviation has nothing to do with that time scale, or the, because basically the dark matter that you're inferring from the velocity dispersion, right, is you know, its tidal radius is way out here. The stars are an order of magnitude inside of that. And so, you know, you do that calculation, you know, say, okay, tides cannot possibly have an effect. All right, but we're assuming equilibrium when we do that, and we're also assuming implicitly that the paracenter of the dwarf's orbit is of order its present distance, which is actually a pretty bad assumption, right? If these things are on fairly elliptical orbits, which you'd expect from the simulations, then, you know, they're spending most of the time at apo. And it's only when they race in at paracenter that most of the damage from tides is going to happen. And in fact, if you look hard at some of the simulations, and it took Joe a while to convince me of this, so I don't expect to convince you of it, but at least in some simulations, and I'll refer you to him, and he's conveniently out of touch,
okay.
As to which simulations, but that you could actually see stars getting puffed out right at paracenter. Okay. Not elsewhere. Now, the time scale thing is still...
I guess I don't understand why we should be seeing most of these at apocenter or near apocenter.
Just if you're on an elliptic orbit, you spend most of your time out there, that's all.
Yeah, you're spending much of
time. But you wouldn't observe it because they would be much farther away.
Well, we don't know what the orbits are. It'd be really nice to know what the orbits are, right? I'm not sure that they are all that elliptical. I'm sure they're somewhat eccentric, but not obvious. It's...
Yes, can you go back to the electricity distance figure? I'm troubled by some of the numbers in there. So the Ursa Major 2 nice picture that you have, has that greater than 0.6, but I think in that paper we estimated it was 0.5. And there are a couple of a pretty recent, maybe just studied objects, Segway 2 and Booties 2, which are very similar to Segway 1. Then the electricity is closer to 0.2 or 0.3. Nearby distances and much lower on the electricity scale.
So I remember there being multiple estimates of electricity for some of these things, and so we picked somebody's, and we picked based on the claimed, we picked based on the claimed error bar, right? And so, you know, then you have to actually trust people to have made this as rational an estimate as you made, which, you know, we actually obsess about that, because right, it's easy to formally get a small error bar and report that. That doesn't necessarily, but we didn't know what else to do. So I'm happy to imagine.
Hold the estimates on.
Yeah.
Valid reason to not believe one or the other, right?
Well, you know, I didn't expect to find anything like this when I did it, and so I'd be happy to do that if somebody wants to look them all up. Big pain.
Like Hercules and Ursa Major are super crazy elliptical. Those are the two highest ranking squares. And they, and we both picked our faves, both I like the elliptic space for those. But there's also a couple of objects that just happen to not be on the figure, maybe the figures were not yet. And they have, they would be green squares with ellipticities around 0.2, 0.3.
So down here. So that fills that in. Okay.
And Ursa Major, too, I mean, look at it, it extends a degree. So you end up kind of quibbling over what the ellipticity is. What scale?
What does that mean? Yeah, no, I agree. This is Sagittarius, by the way. Right, so what does that mean?
Sagittarius, we know who's got that.
Well, exactly. That's what I'm saying. But, I mean, people have made estimates. I think Super Mario made that one. But, So, I mean, this goes back to even, you know, how much you believe the velocity dispersions. I don't see a reason not to do so, but, you know, you really have to know to believe these things. So I'm just showing what we found.
I'm sorry, what is it?
This one.
I'm sorry, I must have missed it. How do you calculate the tidal radius here?
simply the usual thing. You assume the velocity.
It's not an assumption of the theory of the theory.
It doesn't. It's the tidal radius has. It's where the Roche lobes match, right? So.
Yeah, so it's assuming it's on a circular orbit.
Yeah, it's assumed to be a circular orbit.
I just want to make sure this is like.
But you're using the velocity dispersion of the dwarf to estimate its mass.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So it's not the Kini tidal radius.
That would be the let's see how does this go? No, I mean I was illustrating where the it's not the Kini radius. What I'm plotting here is the half-life radius because that's better measured relative to the tidal radius, and this is where the Kini radius would fall, I think, in those units. Forgetting out what I did 2 years ago, man.
I'm sorry. I know you just answered this to Louis. And so the tidal radius was calculated as a lower limit of the tidal radius, assuming that the mass of the object is the half mass, the half light mass.
Yes. Yes. No, that's correct. That's reducing. Yeah, right. Those are the radii and the mass that we're using in that formula. So you have to put in the distance of the satellite and the host mass. You have to put in the size of the satellite and the satellite mass. And so it's a dynamical mass in that half-life radius. So here's a slightly different take on the same thing. This is essentially the same as that, only it's a time scale issue. The deviations, again, correlate with that time scale now. It's the same as the previous plot. The ellipticity does so too, though that may change if these things happen. Now, what you get for the exact number here depends on how you estimate the masses. Okay. So this is the ratio of densities, right? Square root of that. Dynamical time is 1 over square root gr. Zero, right? So, yes, that's right. So it's basically how many times a star makes an orbit within the satellite over how many times the satellite orbits the host. Okay? And it depends on...
Can you give us your motivation for going against this? I can go to another 200 blocks, but why do you pick this number? What is your thinking? What are you trying to disprove or test?
Do you really want to know?
No, I'm serious. I mean, all these things are basically the same kind of thing. I mean, you must have an idea in mind. You come up with the internal orbits per orbit.
That was what Milgram suggested.
Because it's sensitive to what the tidal distortion.
Yeah, because basically it's whether or not a dwarf will be in equilibrium in Mond, right? In Mond, if those things are isolated, they better fall on baryonic Tully Fisher. So I was ready to declare Mond dead because they were way off. Okay, and then I thought, ooh, let's see if Milgram wrote about this. And he actually wrote a paper around 2000 with Brada, where he said, geez, the little dwarfs, and they did some simulations, if they fall in, then they can get kicked around tidally, and they'll no longer be in equilibrium. And you expect that to happen when this becomes of order unity, or actually a bit more.
So what do you think for some moment?
So if you're doing the Mond, and that's why I say it depends entirely on what you put in here. Okay. For the Mond case, you just put in the luminous mass for both the host and the... Just the baryonic mass for both the host and the satellite. Okay.
So this is also related to like whether you do an adiabatic change of the orbit.
Yeah.
Like, so I mean, if you go to one, right? I mean,
it's not adiabatic anymore. Yeah.
Like really, right? Screw up and then you're
just to one. Yeah. So basically. This particular plot, but like I say, you get the same thing if you put in, you know, traditional mass estimators for these things. You just change the scale. But for the specific case where you put in the baryonic masses, then things start to deviate when you start to lose the adiabatic case.
Yeah, that was interesting because if you now look at a case where these double the water unity and you have a high elasticity case, right? It means you have a nice resonance.
Hmm.
So it would be interesting to sort of, have you looked at whether these electricities are pointing towards the galactic center during this orientation event?
You don't expect them to, because they, in the simulations, they trail out and they leave debris trails along their orbits, right? So I would expect...
If the electricity is due to tidal.
Right. So I'd expect there to be streams, but the exact position angle in the simulations isn't neatly correlated with...
But if there is no tidal stripping in the self-bound systems, then there should be some torque acting on the system
that's true.
The resonance would align them nicely.
That's true. I haven't looked for that specific effect. I'm not sure the position, well, some of the position angles are very good.
Does your offset points with these things that point towards the galactic center? And you get your density of stars and then you have those arrows that mysteriously point in different directions?
So I think some of them are on. So something that Dave did in the paper with all these arrows, right? So there's the gradient of the galactic potential. So Kohn-Vera ice is a really nice one. First of all, I'm really comfortable that it's squishy, elasticity appears to be elongated with the gradient of the galactic potential, but you know, like, there's only so many ways you can throw down on that morphology. But in projection, they've measured the angle between the position angle measured for the satellite, each satellite, and the gradient of the galactic potential, and then look at that histogram. And unfortunately, there's nothing in the literature that predicts what this should look like in 2D. There are people, there's a recent paper, Mikowski, at all that look at what that distribution looks like, which looks like in 3D, we may or may not have overplotted the 3D predicted that was observed. And of course, they're kind of similar because everything in nature does that. But you know, if there's a peak around between 20 and 40 degrees angle of separation, what does that mean?
This is exactly why I wanted to come here and describe these things. To get people.
But the problem is the orientation depends on where they are on the orbit. And so you can't make a prediction.
Well, unless you know the Mikowski paper to do the thing.
So I will say this about orbits. Right? In lambda CDM, we expect the dwarfs to be in subhalos that are on pretty eccentric orbits. In Mond, I don't think that can be the case. They would be gone if they were getting beat up at paracenter already. In fact, the dissolution times for these guys is pretty short, hundreds of millions of years. Out here, it's giga years, so maybe not. But so I would expect I wouldn't say they're circular, but I would expect the orbits to be less eccentric, 0.3 or 0.2, something like that. Okay. So it's helpful to have the actual orbits of these guys.
There's something I don't understand. I want to think about this a lot.
Just one thing?
I mean, so there's galaxies. You said one, unless I'm confused about this definition of gamma, one internal orbit per orbit. So I just calculated, given the size of the galaxy, 100 parsecs, and its velocity dispersion. It takes like less than 10 megayears.
But it's the m. It's how you estimate that mass. If you're using the velocity dispersion, you're absolutely right. Right.
So you're saying the intrinsic velocity dispersion of these systems is actually
that's right.
It's overestimated.
Well, the particular numbers on this plot use the baryonic masses. And so in that case, if you put that thing in isolation, then it better be on baryonic Tully Fisher.
Right.
Okay. But what you're saying is that, the crossing time is so short, just because the velocity is really high, that's to wash it out. But if you look at the simulations brought in Milgram run, the things breathe as they orbit. So the velocity dispersions puff up, and then the system expands. And as it orbits between Apo and Perry, it actually breathes. So it's not ever exactly in equilibrium, but while it's still adiabatic, it's actually going through this cycle of expansion and contraction with the velocity dispersion. So even though the crossing time is short, if you look at the velocity dispersion, they're still moving together along the stream. So it's tougher to dismiss than usual.
Well, I think in this expression, mass is completely inconsequential. It's what you take for R meters. It's R cubed. So is that the half-light radius?
Yeah, this is a half-light radius. And that's just the distance, the current distance,
so if
right?
If you're a tidal radius, it would be 1. You take half-light radius, so it has to be greater than 1. And then how much greater is just the degree to which this satellite is self-gravitating and should be from that?
Sure. But it does matter what the masses are, right? Because if you put in dynamical.
These what, the distance of the galaxy from the center, or V is the size of the Milky Way halo?
No, no, it's the distance of the satellite from the center of the Milky Way, or Andromeda.
The
ratio of densities, that's exactly right.
So sorry, your statement about the fact that some halos are expected to be on eccentric orbits.
Yeah.
Doesn't that correlate with infall time, or is that a general statement?
I don't remember that detail.
It is correlated with, because if it's in a very elliptical orbit, it won't survive much.
Right, so I thought, so assuming that these things are tidally distorted, they should be on circular orbits.
Okay. Yeah, right, that's a good point. That's a good point, yeah. There could be a bias that way. In which case, there should be a population of things we still haven't seen that are...
Right.
Yeah, no, that's a good, that's an observationally testable thing. So get busy, Beth. It's hard, right? It's hard to do this. All these theorists who want the data. Okay, so a couple of generic things we talk about. Rosie Weiss, this is not in the paper. Rosie Weiss pointed out after she saw the paper that there are models going back to the 70s built for the globular clusters that you can use the metallicity, as Oleg was saying, that's a fundamental thing, to predict how many baryons have been blown out. Right? So you imagine. A given IMF, you let the, you know, you have one burst, it goes to completion, you get rid of the leftover gas. Okay, so going to completion is also important. So, you know, she gave me a formula, I can plug in a formula, no problem. So based on the metallicity, then you basically shift from here up to here. And that gets back to this line now, this is the cosmic baryon content, right? So this basically does everything you want if these things are subhalos that have lost their gas and are now, you know, the satellites aren't missing anymore. The baryons have been expelled. Most of them have been expelled. Of course, the ultrafaints don't quite get up far enough because they're too far down. But the classical dwarfs, anyway, get back up to about where they ought to be. You can't, because it assumes you go to completion. These things are nowhere near completion. They have 90% gas fractions. So I would like...
I think it says, like, if you've not met any metals, you're primordial. So therefore, yeah.
It's
a
well, I think that's a little unfair. I mean, it's basically true, but it's also... I mean, you know, it didn't have to work out so well, right? And, you know, these are old models. You go through it, and it comes out. The metallicities are not nothing. They're small, but they're not nothing.
It's a completely open box model. That,
yeah, it blows out the baryon.
Probably never work for the small mass galaxies.
Yeah, so we need another thing. And this is what I don't understand, right? I mean, these things basically continue on this trend, the classical ones do. So it seems to me like it ought to be the same mechanism that's doing that. And, you know, Aaron Dutton just sent me a preprint that explains all this.
I mean, there has to be multiple outflow in more massive, at least the old M star.
That
you, more outflow than you would expect a kink.
In many models, you would expect a kink, and there's no evidence for it in this plane. That is my problem with this.
They don't go outside of the halo.
You know, I assume the metallicity is measured in the Milky Way. Metallicity is measured within
in stars.
So 60 or so, I mean, it's...
In these things, yeah.
Yeah, but you don't measure the metallicity.
No, but you got the folks in it and then
folks... Yeah, but for ellipticals, let's say, more massive systems, most massive it takes a whole time or longer.
Well, the other
ones,
these are forming stars.
But these are the questions I want you all to think about, because it's very easy to say, oh, feedback does it all. But it's not actually the same feedback that does this as does that. Okay, and it matters what your model is. And it doesn't do it for the ultrafaints, but maybe, you know, maybe there's something else going on there.
Because when you said yourself, they have not been run to completion. They are 90% gas.
No, I said the ultra faints. These guys, these have not run to completion, but you still need something like this formula to get them up there, but this formula doesn't apply because it assumes you run to completion. That's the point, yeah, that there's a discontinuity there. It looks nice to say it's feedback here and feedback there, but it's not the same feedback. This is where the dwarfs came from, so in the original plot. So this shows you how much they've moved as a result of this correction. Sorry, thank you.
It also assumes that all the variables have been removed in supernova.
Yep. And of course, that can't happen here because you have gas left over, right? So you have to remove a lot of them. You have to remove a lot of them without removing it all, right?
But that's not an issue. That's...
How does it happen? I mean, I know you can build a model that does it. I have great faith in your ability to build models that do anything you want in this plane. It's a different question whether reality works that way or not.
It's because your mass load is much higher in normal mass systems. The first supernova, I blow out many more baryons because my potential is much lower.
Because the potential is smaller.
Higher gas mass fraction means that outflows have been less efficient.
But you have left gas behind. That's my point.
Absolutely.
Okay, so you have to have some geometry that does that. You don't just have a spherical cow.
In order to have a supernova, I need to have a critical amount of gas to be able to make a star to have a supernova go up. So you need gas to have feedback.
Okay, you need stars to have feedback. Now, there are galaxies on here, and they're not all down at this end, that have well over 90% gas fractions. If you extrapolate this trend, there are 50 kilometer a second galaxies that hadn't experienced any feedback. They make one star, and boom, 99% of their baryons leave. Doesn't make any physical sense.
But not that the CPU are the lost thing, right? Because the energy of the feedback is just not comparable with the potential energy that you have, right? With the gravitational energy. You're in a deeper potential well, so you can't remove everything.
At 50 kilometers a second, you still need to remove, on average, something like 80-90% of the baryons.
I guess Stacy's point would be, why is it then that in the dwarfs we don't have 99.99% gas?
I think
that's an interesting point, right?
Yeah.
What happens when I transit from this last gray point to the color point?
Exactly.
But they're very different systems.
There are gray points in here, okay? They do overlap somewhat. They are very different in terms of their stellar content and their gas.
That's my point.
Oh, but this is what I want us to think about, is do we have to have a combination of mechanisms that do this? Okay. Because it looks to me, right, before you make this particular correction, the classical dwarfs were on the tail end and even overlapping with some of the dwarf irregulars. Okay, so my gut feeling is that whatever is doing that is the same mechanism for the dwarf spheroidals and for the dwarf irregulars.
It doesn't have to be so.
Okay, but they end up at the same point in this, well, not in this plot, but in baryonic Tully Fisher. But, you know, there are many effects that can go on, and so we need to understand the lot of them, and it's not just good enough to say, okay, feedback does it all here, and then feedback does it here, because we don't actually mean the same thing by that word in those two cases.
There's a simple calculation you can do. You can ask yourself, what is the minimum mass of stars they need to form in a galaxy to expel the remainder, okay? And then you find out that this number is independent of mass, it only depends on the efficiency of star formation.
Okay.
And so that means that there is a change, I interpret this as a change in the efficiency of star formation between the two populations. So, and in that case, the small ones are able to expel the gas and the big ones cannot. So,
well, okay, yeah. I guess to come back to my point, I guess if we found a galaxy that was pure gas, would it fall on baryonic Tully Fisher, or would it still be up here waiting to remove all its baryons? Because it hasn't made any stars yet.
Yeah.
So it hasn't had any feedback yet.
Ah, okay. Well,
So which is it? Which do you expect? Ah, a prediction.
Okay, so then the only option is that the galaxy is a baryon fraction, because I haven't been able to, no, it doesn't depend. It depends on what my realization is done on that.
Yes.
There's an impulse precedent.
Well, no, I would predict that if you have a galaxy that's pure gas, no stars, it's going to fall on baryonic Tully Fisher. Because that's what I see over and over again. That's just an empirical prediction. If you really believe that feedback is responsible for removing all the baryons, then it's not unreasonable to think it lives up there until the feedback kicks in. And that's a very different prediction.
If you plot the full baryon fraction with respect to our galaxies in a given BC, it will go as the 3.3 power cost, and it will go.
Okay, so it's a little steeper.
No, it could be a velocity, not power 4, as you call it.
This is power 4, it's power 3, so 3.3 is like that.
And it will be higher, probably. So that's
something like that.
For pristine galaxies.
Okay, so it's here instead of here, but that's different from here. So then I will just show one last thing, which is what Nick wanted to talk about. So the other thing that, and I wanted to show the data, so everybody had the picture in their head. People talk about reionization a lot in the context of the local group dwarfs. So this is the model by Crane. Nick has made models with a parameter, and those dashed lines are sort of show the range of what could happen. But basically, there's a fairly sharp cutoff. So we're plotting now the fraction of detected baryons in each system as a function of their circular velocity. And as Nick and others have said, there's a reasonably sharp cutoff around 20 kilometers a second.
Right. So what is Crane? That's also a model for reionization?
Yeah, just a reionization model.
That's the central solid line.
Yeah.
Okay.
Rain.
Fraction of
H0. Basically you reheat the gas, and so you cannot make things down here because those potentials can't hold on to that hot gas.
If I can make a suggestion, Nick will be here tomorrow morning.
Yeah.
It seems like a good time to.
This is. I agree. I just wanted people to be able to see the data rather than me drawing on the board.
Kuhn et al. Does not have a unique background model. The only give an extra entropy distribution and the non emission. We don't have a good model.
Huh?
Yeah, I suggest we talk about it tomorrow.
Okay, that's fine.
I think it's good that you showed this so we all know what you're
doing. Yeah, that was my only point.
Are
I wanted
to put this on the wiki, or is this also
I can
for people to look at?
Sure, I can do that. Do you want all the slides or just the good one here?
Slide? No, I want all of the slides.
All right, yeah, I can do that.
You don't want to steal your
every slide engenders some conversation.
Thank you. So go forth and think.